Spare a moment to think about the device you're using to listen to this episode. Is it a smartphone, a tablet, or your personal computer? You're probably surfing the internet and playing this podcast on a sophisticated app. You may even be wearing wireless headphones. If you're walking down the street, we guarantee you'll see plenty of cars passing by, electric, hybrid, or simply diesel. If you're at home, you're surrounded by objects that make your life easier and more enjoyable. A fridge, a stove, a coffee machine, or a simple toothbrush. Wherever you look, you'll see innovation at play.
Before we continue, Vic, let's stop for a moment. So why do we talk about innovation in an EU-related podcast?
Well, because innovation does not stop with smart dishwashers.
As we will emerge from the pandemic, innovation will be key for the success of our digital and our green agenda. And we all know Europe is a powerhouse in science. Our New Horizon research program is the largest ever. But we also face a big paradox. We Europeans are excellent in making science with money, but we're not so good in making money out of science.
This is Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, speaking at the European Innovation Council launch ceremony in March 2021.
Okay, I see. The point is, innovation is needed to fight pandemics, to transition to a more sustainable economy, and to channel the power of digitalization.
That's right. Innovation can enable plenty of things and can even give entire industries and even nations a first-mover advantage that translates into economic gains.
But of course, all of this provided that we translate innovative ideas into concrete applications that are actually useful.
Indeed. And the EU has its own ambitious plans to stimulate innovation. According to DGRTD, which is the European Commission's Research and Innovation Department, research and innovation are among the most powerful of European policies to boost the Union's economies and competitiveness at the global scale. And the centerpiece of the EU's innovation strategy is the Horizon Europe program.
So you mentioned now Horizon Europe, and also Ursula von der Leyen mentioned Horizon Europe before. What is that exactly?
Horizon Europe is the EU's main instrument to fund research and development. It has a budget of almost 100 billion euros until 2027. And the goal of the program is to strengthen the EU's scientific and technological base to make the EU more competitive and more autonomous in technological sectors considered as strategic. This includes semiconductors, quantum computing, and of course, artificial intelligence, AI.
Wow, you mentioned all of the hot buzzwords in a single sentence. Well done.
Thank you. I've been practicing hard.
But how exactly does Horizon Europe work?
Well, researchers, universities, national governments, the private sector, and civil society, usually teaming up in transnational consortia, can apply for Horizon Europe funding for research and technology projects in almost any area. It is actually under Horizon Europe that many other R&I, or Research and Innovation European initiatives, are funded, including the European Institute of Innovation and Technology and the European Innovation Council.
Oh, that's interesting. But Horizon Europe is not the first research program that was created by the EU, is it?
You're absolutely right. Horizon Europe is not new. Well, the name kind of is, but the program has been around for a while. Horizon Europe is the European Union's 9th framework program for research and innovation.
Ah, framework program. What a beautiful EU expression.
I agree. You can also call it FP for short. Actually, the EU's first framework program, or FP1, ran from 1984 to 1987 and had a budget just shy of 4 billion euros. Each new edition of the framework program has grown in budget, which since 2007 is allocated for a period of 7 years in line with the EU's long-term budget. The current Horizon Europe program, or FP9, is the biggest ever. It is also the one with the strongest focus on innovation.
Okay, are there any other EU funding schemes for research and innovation?
If the EU is known for one thing, is its complexity. There are many other EU financial instruments that support innovation either directly or indirectly. But we're not going to go in more detail into any of them. Suffice it to say that Horizon Europe is the EU's largest R&I weapon. Furthermore, in summer last year, the European Commission issued a new European Innovation Agenda. This is a new document, but it's not really about new funding. It introduces new actions to support the development and uptake of deep tech innovation in the European Union. Deep tech refers to technology solutions that require lengthy research and development and substantial capital investment before successful commercialization. We're not talking about consumer apps or developing a new coffee maker. but about technology that focuses on hard-to-solve challenges, such as nuclear fusion, synthetic biology, quantum computing, or even space exploration. So the EU has the commitment, the funding, and the drive to encourage innovation across all EU member states.
So now you told me all about these like shiny, expensive EU-funded research programs. But I feel that the million-dollar question is, can the EU really engineer innovation?
Welcome to EU Untangled, the podcast that tries, sometimes successfully, to make sense of EU policies and politics. I'm Victor Aguilar, joining from Brussels.
And my name is Alex Roth, joining from Berlin.
Today's episode brings together the voices of innovation experts to help us unravel a rather tangled topic, the role of the EU in encouraging innovation.
But let's start first with the basics. What is innovation and why should we care about it?
An innovation is a new or improved product or process that differs significantly from the unit's previous products or processes, and it has been made available to potential users. So there's a bunch of things in there, products, processes. So it's not always that we see innovation necessarily as a consumer. Can also be business to business. It's also centered on the users. So it's not just a scientific advance, but actually a new product that users can use or processes.
This is Paul Hünermann, assistant professor at the Department of Strategy and Innovation at Copenhagen Business School. When defining innovation, he refers to the Oslo Manual, an international reference guide for collecting and using data on innovation. The manual was developed and is regularly updated by the European Union and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. Crucially, Paul says, innovation is not just about having new ideas, but about applying them.
I would say it's not just an idea, right? So that, I think, it distinguishes innovation from, let's say, arts or science, right? If it's purely a new idea without any new applications, then it's not necessarily an innovation the way we would define it. But of course, the boundaries are fluent there.
To be a bit more concrete, we ask Paul to share some of his favorite examples of innovation made in Europe.
Recently, one of the big success stories were the COVID-19 vaccines, and Europe played an important role there. The mRNA technology, well, BioNTech in Germany, teaming up with Pfizer in the US. We also had a couple of other pharmaceutical companies. So that's definitely a huge success story, and the entire COVID-19 pandemic could have turned out very differently if we wouldn't have had these innovations so quickly as well.
Actually, out of the 8 COVID-19 vaccines currently authorized by the European Medicines Agency for use in the EU, 6 were developed by European companies or through partnerships with European companies.
Paul also goes a bit further back in history when reflecting about his favorite innovation examples.
In the past, I mean, many examples. Of course, the printing press is something that we use in teaching a lot.
That's right. The movable type printing press invented by German goldsmith Johannes Gutenberg in around 1440, which led to the spread of literature in Europe and eventually a global information revolution. Paul also shared a less obvious example of innovation.
For me personally, since I enjoy drinking coffee a lot, it's probably the development of coffee culture in Europe and the Ottoman Empire that comes to mind.
Coffee culture? I must admit, I did not see this one coming.
I agree. After all, coffee seeds come originally from African plants that somehow made it from Kefa in Ethiopia to Yemen, then the rest of the Middle East, eventually Europe, and finally the rest of the world.
Of course, the raw product has been known for ages. And I think that's a nice illustration of innovation. It's not just the raw product. It's also the entire culture around it, the way how we deliver it. And I'm thinking about the coffee culture that developed in Vienna in the 15th century. So that is all related to innovation and how we enjoy a new product that comes to the market.
I see. It seems like innovation is about new ideas, new processes, new uses, and of course, new products. But it can also be about more intangible things like new traditions and new cultures. However, isn't the bigger question not what innovation is, but why it really matters?
Innovation is the main driver of economic growth and by that prosperity in general. In a more philosophical way, technology makes humans more powerful, and that can be a source of good if it's used in the right way. Of course, it can also backfire if it's used in the wrong way, but in generally, technology has been an important driver of human progress in history.
If technological innovation can drive progress, then those that innovate have a competitive advantage. Over the past 500 years, also known as the modern era, Europe has been the birthplace of major technological developments, including the printing press, the steam engine, the microscope, vaccines, the telegraph, and the automobile. Each of them gave way to a new age of possibilities, discoveries, and progress. Some of these inventions even led to revolutions in science, information, and industry.
But it seems that in recent decades, other regions of the world were more successful in innovation. In the last 30 to 40 years, for example, many innovations have happened in the digital sphere. All things related to the personal computer, the internet, smartphones, and now even artificial intelligence. This begs the question, where does the EU stand today compared to the rest of the world? Can Europe still be considered an innovation champion?
Yeah, that's a complex question. I think if we compare Europe to the US, then the US would definitely still be at the innovation frontier because of Silicon Valley, the kind of startups that come out there. And if you just compare growth rates in recent decades, Europe is definitely a laggard compared to the US. We have actually similar GDP growth rates across Europe and the US, but Europe starting from a much lower base. So that means the gap in GDP per capita is widening. And most of the strong growth that we see in Europe is driven by Eastern European countries. Those are the European tiger states like Poland, Czech Republic, the Baltic states. And that is, of course, driven also by a fair amount of what we call catch-up growth. So catching up to the technology frontier. I think China is a different story. Maybe in my view, China a bit overemphasized the sort of growth that we've seen there. And there are many obstacles that China will face in the future. Of course, then countries like India and South America, it's a complete different story because that is more like a development process catching up with the international research frontier.
Paul mentioned the research frontier, which is an academic term that describes the latest cutting-edge research.
The hot stuff.
That's right.
But before we can answer the question where the EU stands, don't we have first to ask ourselves, how do we measure innovation?
The European Union publishes each year a European Innovation Scoreboard, a comparative analysis of innovation performance in EU member states, the EU as a whole, and other countries around the world. The scoreboard measures innovation across 12 dimensions using 32 indicators. These include the number of new doctorate graduates in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, the percentage of people holding higher education degrees, international scientific publications per million people, the level of digitalization of the country, public sector spending in R&D, and the number of patent, trademark, and design applications.
So it seems you had a look at the scoreboard, Vic. So how is the EU doing?
Well, the latest edition, which was released in July of this year, reported that the EU's innovation performance continues to grow, closing performance gaps with other countries. This is good news. This means that the EU as a bloc performs better than Japan and China. However, it is still behind South Korea, Canada, the US, and Australia. A different benchmark is the EU Industrial R&D Investment Scoreboard. This shows that EU-based companies accounted for less than 20% of global investments in R&D in 2021, whereas US companies were responsible for 40% of global investments. Crucially, R&D investment in the sectors driving the global tech race today, this is ICT, health, and automotive, was higher for US and Chinese companies than for EU firms.
This is interesting. So on paper, and according to some of the data you just mentioned, the EU has many ingredients to be an innovation leader and to attract investments. For instance, the EU produces 1/5 of all top quality publications, despite being home to only 6% of the world's population. And according to the European Investment Bank, the EU and the US lead in overall patent counts, surpassing even China. But at the same time, the EU struggles quite a bit to be more innovative and to attract investments. Isn't that contradictory?
That's the European paradox that we're debating for many years already. So a strong scientific base, if you look at indicators such as publications and how well the universities are doing compared to bringing that that innovation to the market, translating it into new companies, new products, new processes. And yeah, we talked about the definition of innovation, that is an important part of it. We need to translate these scientific advances also into new commercial applications. And yeah, there's certainly no easy answer to this. I think an important part or important role in this is, of course, like the still fragmentation of the European market. For example, for a new startup, it would be very difficult to scale quickly and internationalize because, framework conditions are still not harmonized. And that would be much easier in a market like the US or even India and China. Then, I mean, we can talk about regulations that have not always been conducive to economic growth. We've seen that, for example, in the digital sphere. And then there are just a couple of general roadblocks like the demographic development in Europe. Europe is aging, which can be a problem for innovation. Still, I think we have made a lot of progress in the past, but language barriers are still there. That reduces the mobility of labor. And these are all input factors for innovation.
Paul highlights a few very interesting points that really call for more harmonization of the European market, don't they? But maybe the EU is just not spending enough money to be a top innovation leader. I had a look at a few numbers. Over the last decade, the EU as a bloc has increased its spending in research and development. In 2021, the EU spent close to 2.2% of its GDP, which is the overall income of the EU, which represents a 40% increase compared to 2011, so quite a bit. However, the EU's R&D expenditure relative to GDP remains well below that of the US, which spends 3.5%, Japan, which spends 3.3%, and China, which spends 2.4%.
That's an important insight. However, Paul would warn us about paying too much attention to just one indicator.
Putting one number is difficult because innovation is a multidimensional construct, and we can try, and I think that's a good idea to measure innovation in several ways and track several indicators, and by that hopefully get a more holistic picture. Traditionally, we in the economics of innovation, we distinguish between innovation input or R&D input and output. So input would be just raw R&D spending and output such as, patents, scientific publications. At a more macro level, it's GDP growth because we think that there's a strong correlation between innovation and GDP growth. But all of these indicators also have their weaknesses, of course. Not everything is patented. New startups often rarely patent their innovations and secure intellectual property in other ways, like secrecy, which is even harder for us than to measure if innovators keep their innovations secret. Also, scientific publications. We've seen sort of an inflation of scientific publications in the past. That is also a problem if we try to assess the innovation potential of countries like China, because in China there have been premiums or subsidies for scientific publications and patents. So one number is difficult. From a very broad perspective, the number would be probably GDP growth, but there's also good reasons to think about that GDP doesn't capture all of economic activity, especially if we compare it across Europe and the US, for example. And otherwise, I think, the R&D scoreboard and these kinds of indicators, they're deliberately multidimensional and try to track several aspects.
Wait, why do small companies not always patent their publications?
Yeah, I asked Paul the exact same thing.
For startups, it's quite costly to apply for a patent, especially if you apply for a European patent. That can be going up to 30,000, 40,000 euros. So that's just a cost factor. But then also, like, it's a lengthy process. It's a legal process. Startups have to move fast. So they often rely on what we call more informal intellectual property strategies, like, for example, secrecy or non-disclosure agreements, or simply lead time being fastest on the market, so fast on the market that no one can actually catch up and imitate these kind of innovations.
Paul also struck a note of caution about focusing too much on indicators and losing sight of the end goal. Countries such as the US and China might lead on some aspects, but just focusing on matching their investments and outputs is not necessarily the strategy to follow here in the European Union.
We need to be careful not to confuse the indicator with which we measure something and the actual thing we care about. And I think China is a great example. The Chinese Communist Party has the goal to become a scientific leader in the world. And so they incentivized all sorts of innovation activities. We've seen that in the past, but sometimes also in questionable ways, like, for example, well, party officials are remunerated based on the number of patents that a region produces. And I mean, there's this old saying that whenever you make an indicator a target, people will adjust their behavior according to this. So we have actually good studies comparing the quality of Chinese patents to the raw numbers of patents. And the raw numbers are definitely going up, but probably the quality has been declining in recent decades. So there seems to be an inflation there. And yes, patents are correlated with R&D input, definitely. But also there, it depends on how efficient or effective this R&D spending is. And if you have the goal to both increase R&D spending and get more patents out, you will probably see progress on these indicators. But that doesn't mean that you are necessarily fast catching up with the research frontier. And it's similar with startups. Some startups operate in sectors where formal intellectual property protection is really important, like biotech, and their patents would be a good indicator. In other sectors, not so much, but often we don't have better indicators to use, right? I mean, it's hard to observe innovation at the micro level. So often we're left with these imperfect proxies that do say something if you track them over time, and it's important to track them, but we need to be careful about the interpretation that we put on those numbers.
Okay, innovation is fundamental to economic progress and prosperity. It seems to be difficult to measure, but what's then the EU strategy to get better innovation, and how does it plan to overcome the issue that the EU does a lot of research but gets relatively little innovation out of it?
As mentioned at the start of this episode, the European Union has set in motion ambitious plans to ramp up innovation. One of the flagship proposals is the European Innovation Council, or EIC, which was launched in November 2021 with the goal to identify, develop, and scale up breakthrough technologies and game-changing innovations.
Oh, that sounds nice, but again, a bit buzzwordy. What makes the EIC different from other EU initiatives?
To understand why the EIC was created and what makes it special, I spoke to Liene Briede. She is the Vice Rector for Innovation at Riga Technical University and the European Innovation Council board member.
I believe it's the Europe answer to this high-risk innovation processes or investment processes. If we look in the Europe innovation agenda, Europe has invested a lot of money in research process. And then we go to this impact phase. So if it's enough with that kind of programs that we had before to scale and take a high level risk of investment to help startups grow. So most of the startups and spin-off in the last period went to United States to take this ticket. Because for breakthrough technologies, the investment is needed is millions. It's not 100,000 euros. It's like mainly popular in acceleration program and similar support mechanisms.
So basically, what she is saying is that before the EIC, the programs that the EU had in place did not offer the investments that could encourage the development of breakthrough technologies. These kind of investments require millions of euros that entrepreneurs could not find here in Europe.
That's exactly right. Investing in developing new tech is risky, especially at the beginning. it requires a lot of money and there are no guarantees that it will work out. You can win big time, but you can also lose big time. So the EU sort of said, hey, we're a big public institution with a decent budget. Maybe we can take that risk. That's why Liene calls the EIC Europe's answer to high-risk innovation.
That sounds like a gamble. How much money is the EIC betting and how can companies get a piece of that funding?
The EIC has a total budget of 10.1 billion euros to be spent between 2021 and 2027. This budget is meant to provide individual companies with financial support through a combination of grants and investments. Companies can apply in one of three funding schemes, depending on the maturity of the project that they have. The first is the EIC Pathfinder, which funds advanced research on breakthrough technologies. The second is EIC Transition, which helps transform research results into innovation opportunities. This includes maturation and validation of novel technology in the lab and application environments, as well as the development of a business case and model. The third and final funding scheme is the EIC Accelerator, which provides funding to develop and scale up breakthrough innovations with high risk and high impact. This is meant for startups looking for substantial funding, but where the risks involved are too high for private investors to commit any money on their own. According to Liene, the EIC targets the entire value chain of innovation, from research to scale-up. More importantly, the EIC is centered on individual entrepreneurs and startups, providing them the flexibility they need to develop, mature, and scale up their innovations.
I believe the EIC, first of all, it's this high-risk investment in breakthrough technologies. And also this value chain starting from Pathfinder to Transition, it's extremely important to give opportunity for those scientists or SMEs who have these crazy ideas where nobody knows it will work, that you give opportunity to try. It's also high-risk research process. And you don't know what the result will be. So that's why there are these three phases to try it out. And I believe for innovation, there should be more flexibility. We should be faster. We should have this more individual approach regarding the beneficiaries. And it's extremely needed in Europe. So I believe the EIC has changed the way how Europe treats innovations.
So it seems like the EIC is focused on bridging the gap between what they call lab to fab. From testing a new solution at a small scale in a controlled environment, the lab, to the manufacturing and commercialization of the solution at a much larger scale, the fab.
From the lab to the fab. We must translate our excellence in research into industrial innovation.
This is President Ursula von der Leyen again, speaking at the EU Industry Days a year ago. She was referring to the EU's ambition to be at the frontier of chip design. However, her comments echo well beyond this area. In artificial intelligence, for example, the US captured 40% of external funding between 2015 and 2020. Asia, including China, captured 32%, whereas Europe captured only 12%, according to McKinsey, a consultancy. The European Investment Bank has indicated that Europe's venture capital ecosystem mainly provides early stage finance, which would be the lab, but underperforms in subsequent rounds of financing, the fab, which is about expansion and growth.
Is there any structured way to define or even measure the maturity of a technology?
Yes. In the tech ecosystem, the maturity of a technology is measured in what they call technology readiness levels, or TRL. There are 9 levels. From TRL 1, which covers basic technology research, to TRL 9, when the solution has been proven in an operational environment and is ready for actual application in its final form.
And so the EU's problem lies at the later stages, I assume?
Exactly. According to Liene, before the EIC existed, the EU had focused on funding tech ideas in the initial TRL stages, up to TRL 4. The problem, however, is that investors are interested in funding more mature technology, starting at TRL 8, when an operational prototype is ready. This leaves a huge gap for levels 5 to 7, concerned with technology validation.
So question is, who will finance this? And it's most costly. How you from lab build a real scale prototype, you validate it, tested in the market, and then you are able to attract investor because you are ready. This middle is extremely risky and extremely costly. It's the most costly process or at least step in all value chain.
This is where the EIC's transition funding program kicks in.
And this transition program gives the opportunity to bring this from lab to fab, at least. My wish would be that in Europe would be more and more programs that bring some readiness level innovations to the next phase with support, because industry is not ready to invest in this risky part. There's no maybe clear support from government or from Europe, then it just stays in labs.
But the EIC's high-risk, high-gain approach does not come without challenges of its own. In a way, the EU is itself innovating with this program.
Exactly, and that's why everyone is looking on EIC with the question, so, show us how you will do it. And there has been a lot of challenges, because if the EIC itself is ready for such kind of process, the system and all these partners that we need to count on wasn't ready to do things fast, to make decisions, to establish a new procedures, to change the way how we look at applications. So small things, but when you count them all together, we see that, hey, we need to change this, we need to change this, we need to change this. And in Europe, it's not fast. We could be faster. And time, startup-wise, is money. Startups can't wait when we will be ready to give them money. They need it now, because maybe now this innovation that they have applied is breakthrough, but after some 6 months, it will be old news. It's also important, this technology cycles that we are measuring, they become shorter and shorter. Time is crucial.
So startups with bright ideas need a lot of money, and they need it fast. You said that the ESC has a budget of 10.1 billion euros to be spent in 7 years. Is that a lot, too little, or just enough? I mean, to put 10 billion euros in perspective, according to Eurostat, in 2021 alone, the 27 EU member states spent a total of 328 billion on research and development. This is more than 30 times the 7-year budget of the ESC. And to make a different comparison, 10 billion euros is just a fourth of what Elon Musk spent roughly for buying Twitter. He spent $44 billion. So maybe 10 billion euros is peanuts in the world of venture capital.
You have a point. Lene told me that on the one hand, the success rate of applicants who apply for EIC funding is extremely low, between 2 and 10% depending on the funding scheme. You could look at this as the budget not being enough to fund all the great ideas out there. Alternatively, you can see it as a way to prioritize the very best of them. It means that whoever gets a piece of the cake, well, they get a big piece of the cake. On the other hand, Liane recognizes that estimating whether 10 billion euros is enough to jumpstart game-changing innovations across the EU is not an easy task, especially since the EIC is a new approach to developing deep tech. Liane had some thoughts on this.
It's always a big question how much money you need to make a change. And I'm not sure that we have the answer, and I'm not sure if somebody has answer for it, but it's important. If we want to make a change, you need to invest at least the same amount that has been invested in other markets. And if we look again to Asia or United States, do they invest more? Yes. Could Europe invest more? Yes. But there is also one big difference, especially regarding United States. If we look in this United States company list, top, let's take 50 company in the world, I don't want to be wrong, but I believe 90% are located there. And they also has make a big change regarding the innovation ecosystem. From one hand, it's opportunity, but from other hand, it's also a little bit threat. Because if you have so big companies, they somewhere regulate specific topics or the market. Question if they supporting innovations or they kill innovations. For Europe, this is a chance because we don't have so many big companies, global companies who regulate all the market. So it's possibility for startups to build this global wise company here in Europe and then move to the United States or other big market. That could be a strategy. And for that, we should have this Europe support to really work on it. And then they can go globally by themselves.
So only throwing money on the problem is not the only solution, but it will help for sure. Overall, the EIC seems to be quite an interesting institution. But do we have any facts on whether it actually works? Does it do its job?
Well, the European Commission published last year an impact report. According to this document, EIC funding has supported more than 1,600 startups to date, and this help has translated into more than 1,300 innovations. At the same time, the EIC seems to have generated 12 deep tech unicorns. These are startup companies with a value of over 1 billion euros. Moreover, the entire portfolio of companies that have received EIC funding has attracted 10 billion euros in follow-on investment and generated almost 7,000 jobs. Taken together, all these companies are valued today at 40 billion euros. This sounds great, but we must take these results with a pinch of salt, because the report considers the programs that preceded the EIC and the impact that they had between 2014 and 2021. During that period, the EIC was in a kind of testing phase. Still, the numbers are encouraging. In sticking to innovation analogies, we can say that the EIC has reached an important level of technological maturity. Now that it has been fully deployed in the market, the EIC's impact should be even larger.
Okay, EU actions are having some impact and encouraging innovation. A fair question would be whether this impact can be felt across the EU or if it is concentrated in some regions or member states. The US is well known for its Silicon Valley, where many of the dominating big tech companies were founded or have their headquarters. Alphabet, Apple, Meta, Nvidia, and Intel were all born in this tiny speck of the San Francisco Bay Area. Where do we see innovation taking place in Europe? Do we have our own Silicon Valley?
That's a great question. The European Innovation Scoreboard shows that there is a significant innovation divide in the EU along geographical lines. Scandinavian and Benelux countries, meaning Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg, rank as innovation leaders, whereas Eastern European countries and the Baltics are moderate or emerging innovators. Revealingly, the top innovators among EU member states are the same as the top performers in digital. This includes Denmark, Sweden, Finland, and the Netherlands, who rank at the top of both the EU's latest innovation scoreboard and the Digital Economy and Society Index.
And what about cities? I heard that Berlin and Paris have a lot of tech startups.
You heard right. According to Startup Heatmap Europe, big European capitals are strong innovation hubs. Cities such as Berlin, Paris, and Amsterdam rank as the highest startup ecosystems in the EU. Stockholm alone has more tech unicorns per capita than any other region in the world, except for Silicon Valley, of course. So the EU does seem to have innovation hubs. Here is Paul Hunermund again from the Copenhagen Business School.
We do have innovation hubs and clusters, and I think they're fairly well correlated with the urban centers that we would immediately think of, right? So I'm thinking of Amsterdam, generally the Benelux regions or Brussels with the KU Leuven as a big university there. Copenhagen, then the Baltic states, Vilnius, Poland, Warsaw, Barcelona, Milan, Munich, Berlin. It's interesting to see, I think, that this aligns very well with the big urban center. So it's not very surprising that it's those regions or those cities that stand out. So there's nothing like a Silicon Valley in Europe, where, I mean, okay, Silicon Valley is close to San Francisco, which is a big urban center, but it used to be a completely agricultural land in the past. And then due to smart local policy and agglomeration effects, we have this sprawling tech ecosystem there. And in Europe, I don't think we have something similar, like a region that would stand out, that is completely surprising that we see innovation there. It's also, I mean, I mentioned these several examples that can be a plus, that it's not all concentrated in one area, but at the same time, we do think that there's sort of gains from agglomeration and inventors being close to each other, companies locating close to each other. And in Europe, it is still also, because of historical reasons, quite scattered. So we have many, innovation hubs, but no hub stands out like Silicon Valley would do.
So what are these places doing right? Is there a lesson to learn from them?
Yes. So I think what these places do well is, like you said, there are usually good universities there, which is a catalyst for innovation and entrepreneurship for sure. They are reasonably attractive for foreign talent. So Stockholm, Amsterdam does attract foreigners. And let's say for European standards, it's quite easy to move there and for example, start a new business. And we also have venture capital systems in place, for example, in Berlin or Milan. But it's still at a lower level like in the US. So it's more widespread, and it can also be a plus, right? Because in the US, it's really focused on a few regions, let's say the Boston region, Silicon Valley, and we have these huge inequalities across regions. That is something that we try to avoid in Europe. And also because of our history, we are more successful at this. But at the same time, each country tries to set up their own innovation ecosystem, right, and attract foreign talent. And that creates a little bit of a scattered landscape.
So it seems that universities, good working conditions, and availability of capital are the key ingredients for a successful innovation hub.
Yep. But Paul also warned about getting too fixated on success stories, because luck has a role to play.
Yeah, so Stockholm is certainly one example, but I mean, with unicorns, there's also an element of luck always involved, right? It's not a given that like Spotify became so big and won the competition against a big rival like Apple, for example. So it's nice to have these success stories, but we shouldn't rely too much on them, and we should look at the broader picture. Even though a region like Stockholm is doing very well, we had also like Tallinn in the past, like is a digital hub, for example, Berlin with a for European standards big venture capital funding system. But I still don't see, for example, that a young entrepreneur fresh out of college would feel motivated to now move to Stockholm from, let's say, Italy or France. And that is happening in the US. Like, young aspiring entrepreneurs from all over the US move to, Silicon Valley because that's where the venture capitalists sit. That's where you get funding, the right talent. And in Europe, we still have, roadblocks like labor mobility, right? Like if you move from Italy to Stockholm, you face a completely different legal environment. And these are the challenges that we're facing still.
So the EU has a scattered landscape of innovation hubs instead of a dominant region or a dominant city that attracts all startups and entrepreneurs. And Paul mentioned again that there is a lack of funding and that Europe is not harmonized enough to move easily around. But perhaps this is not so bad after all. Maybe it's better to have several smaller hubs instead of a big one?
It depends on the glasses that you put on. It is true that certain regions concentrate talent and innovation. For example, according to the European Investment Bank, 4 EU member states are home to more than 50% of all EU AI and blockchain SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises. These 4 states are Germany, France, Spain, and the Netherlands. You could argue that this concentration could lead to inequalities or market inefficiencies. However, according to Paul, this is only true if you believe that innovation is a zero-sum game, where one person's gains are another person's losses. He actually believes that innovation has spillover effects.
I think that definitely these kind of spillover effects, so across regions, if one region is doing well, it will spill over to other regions too and create this kind of win-win situation. We even see that if we compare the European Union and the US, there are studies showing that even if inventors move to the US and start a business there, that looks like a loss for Europe, but there's actually knowledge coming back the other way too, and Europe on net actually benefits from this out migration too, and that can work also within European regions. But of course, this is sort of a long run process, and we shouldn't be too myopic in this. And there's a danger that also from a political perspective, we see or we regard innovation as a zero-sum game, like if one benefits, the other loses. That's definitely not the case. We know that there are many studies out there, but it's we always have to keep that in mind and not think too myopically.
So Europe does not have a Silicon Valley of its own, and it seems that innovation brings positive effects across borders, even if startups and venture capital are concentrated in one single place. So does the EU even need a Silicon Valley? Does it make sense?
I asked Liene, the EAC board member, who had a very clear answer.
No, we don't need the Silicon Valley here. We have so many different countries with the different ecosystems, with different history, with different approach to innovation policies, etc. So we are not able to put them all in one frame.
For her, the solution lies in Europe working as an ecosystem that takes national differences into account and bridges gaps between member states.
We need to look in our ecosystem as a unit, but not forget that we are separate. So that we somehow align this investment in innovation between the country. My concern is that the last countries or those not so developed and the highest countries, the difference is 3 times. It's not 10%, it's not 20, it's 3 times, it's 300%. It shows that we're not planning Europe as a one market and one unit regarding the innovation performance. And it's wrong direction. Because we are strong as our weakest point is. and I know that Latvia is the one of the last countries. But anyway, if we look in Europe as a whole market, unit market, it's extremely important to try to make a less difference between these countries.
Without a better playing field among member states, there is little incentive for the more innovative regions in the EU to collaborate with the less innovative ones. She explained that, for instance, Latvia, and for that matter the Baltic states in general, are young independent nations whose industry was largely based on the needs of the Soviet regime. The Baltics are trying to catch up, but the starting point is very different. Even if they are making good progress, change takes time. To help bridge performance gaps, the EU announced last year in its new innovation agenda the creation of 100 European innovation ecosystems.
That sounds like another flashy EU policy, Vic. Please enlighten me.
The goal of this initiative is to connect EU regions with a low innovation performance with highly innovative regions in the EU and encourage partnerships between them. The idea is to build on regional strengths and coordinate R&I investments. And for that, the EU will be pouring 170 million euros into this initiative. Actually, in September, the European Commission will hold the first matchmaking event to help national and regional organizations find innovation partners and explore collaboration opportunities. Don't get confused. This isn't Tinder running on EU funding. But if somebody out there thinks that an app to help regions swipe right on one another is a good idea, please give some credit to EU Untangled. On a more serious note, though, while Liene believes that these kind of initiatives have good intentions, she warns of putting too much faith in artificially engineered cooperation. She draws on the example of her own country, Latvia.
We just applied for one of these instruments together with one of our champions that we would love to learn from. But then question wise, as Latvia, we are interested. 100%. We wrote the project. We did everything. Why champions should be interested? they have another priorities, not to trying to help some country here in Europe. But this is understandable. They have different agenda, different priorities. Why they should, because of the budget of the project? Not really. So let's be honest, they are not interested.
What you need, she says, is not only good intentions and a commitment to shared values. What you need is a business case.
In the long term, not in a project frame, because project budget is not enough to make this interest high.
She seems to be saying that without a business case, there is an incentive for the more technologically developed member states to engage with less tech-savvy countries, not because they see an opportunity, but because they must. Well, this would turn the whole effort into a checkbox exercise that does not go too far and does not have the intended effect.
That's exactly right.
So, speaking of incentives that play against innovation, some people worry that the EU could damage its own competitiveness and innovation potential by overregulating in other areas, such as the digital space. Vic, you know a thing or two about the EU's digital policies. What is the state of the discussion there?
Well, some critics say that, for instance, the Artificial Intelligence Act will regulate a technology where the EU does not have an edge vis-a-vis the US or China, whereas other pieces of legislation, such as the Digital Services Act and the Digital Markets Act, are seen as setting a ceiling to the growth of companies, scaring Europe's future unicorns from even hatching. By the way, EU Untangle has an entire episode on these digital files, so make sure to listen to it if you want to learn more about them. Also, there is some evidence that e-commerce platforms had to trade off efficiency for compliance after the EU's General Data Protection Regulation, the GDPR, came into force in 2018. Other studies show that while large tech companies were relatively unaffected by the GDPR, small and medium-sized companies experienced a decline in profits. So the question is whether the EU can afford to push for more regulation while also encouraging innovation.
First of all, my dear Vic, unicorns don't hatch. They're mammals, not reptiles.
My bad, Alex. I gotta get my facts straight.
But you have a good point. Is EU legislation friend or foe to innovation?
I ask this same question to Paul Hünermund.
Yeah, that's a complex topic. And you mentioned it already. It's about finding the right balance. There are pieces of evidence that we've already seen, for example, with GDPR. We've seen that submissions to the App Store from European countries went down in the aftermath. So we've seen basically fewer innovation in the digital sphere due to GDPR. Now that doesn't necessarily mean that all of these apps that would have been out there without GDPR were necessarily great apps, right? Maybe some of them were even harmful in the sense that they were violating consumer privacy or were based on questionable business models. That just goes to say, like, we should not strive for economic growth at all cost, but we need to be very mindful that we're not over-regulating the market and pushes towards more regulation in the EU, or the idea of industrial champions coming back for some governments, right? Micromanagement in the green transition and mission-driven innovation policies. These are things that make me worried that we might tilt too much to what the French call dirigisme. In Europe. So we need to be mindful about that. Regulation per se can even be a source of innovation. For example, if we set strict environmental standards that can motivate some companies to move away from polluting business models and invest in green innovation. But we have to be very careful about it, how we set these framework conditions.
All right. The EU is trying to find the right balance between regulation and innovation. There is a strong drive to get this right, and there seems to be a political will. But how do we make sure that our innovation efforts are paying off? How can we know that the EU is going in the right direction?
Well, the EU does have its Innovation Scoreboard, which we discussed earlier, and which is updated every year to track how member states and the EU as a whole square up to other innovation powerhouses. So there is no shortage of indicators. For Liene Briede, however, innovation is not only about the destination, but about the journey.
Innovation is process. It's not the result. It's not the technology itself. It's a whole process. So that's why I see that this is the way how we can impact and solve maybe also the global challenges that we have and use this know-how that we have within the different stakeholders like universities, industry, governance. And it's good possibility to bring all these stakeholders together.
Technological innovation by itself would not magically solve problems. It is part of the answer, but it's not the answer itself. The innovation process helps create dialogue among stakeholders and nudge them to share and apply their know-how to meet challenges.
Yet, the question remains, how do we measure our efforts to develop breakthrough innovations?
During our conversation, Liene quoted Einstein, who famously said that you cannot solve a problem with the same mind that created it. She was referring to the potential of breakthrough innovations to help us tackle existing challenges. I would argue that you cannot evaluate innovations with the same mind that funded their development.
So if it's breakthrough, how you can evaluate it? There's no previous experience in the market.
Precisely because of this challenge in evaluating breakthrough innovations, she made an argument for investors to put their money not only on tech, but also on people, on the minds and hands that can make innovation happen. Here, Europe can learn from other regions, like the US.
They invest in the team, not in technology, because they don't understand technology as investors. They don't have this background specific, I don't know, in chemistry or biotechnology, nanotechnology, whatever. So then you invest in the people and then it's safe. If the technology will not work out, then people will figure out how to deal with it and they will figure out another technology. In Europe, all these decades, we have invested in technologies, not in the people, because this is the framework again. We go to the framework. We should have the result, and the result is technology.
Well, that sounds interesting. Investing in people is a safe bet that pays off. That makes sense to me. Unless EU countries invest in people and skills, there won't be the talent pool of Europeans who can develop, implement, and oversee the next generation of tech innovations.
I couldn't have said it better. Not to end on a sour note, I asked Paul and Liene to put on rose-tinted glasses, peer into the future, and tell me where they see innovation happening in the EU in the coming years. Paul shared his vision for the EU. Liene shared hers for Latvia.
Yeah, so certainly we're very strong in traditional sectors like pharmaceuticals. So Novo Nordisk here in Denmark being one prime example. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I hope that, for example, also car manufacturing, traditionally very strong in Germany, will have a resurgence in terms of innovation when we move to electrical cars. I also hope that we will be able to catch up in digital and AI and machine learning. I think we're, again, quite strong there on the scientific side of things, but I would like to see more entrepreneurship and more commercial applications in the future then.
As a small country, we should prioritize things where we are ready to invest. I believe that one direction we should look for is space. So space technologies, there's a lot of great companies here and do a lot of things. So we should strengthen this field with additional support. Then we really hope that we can become a part of the chip value chain. We see that there is possibility for Latvia build a new industry around it. I should name also the defense sector. I don't believe that there's possibility that we will build an industry around it, like tough industry, but our situation, it's quite tough regarding our neighbors. And so the security and defense should be prioritized also regarding the innovations. And one that I would love to add is biotechnologies, is something that we want to also add on our portfolio.
That's an interesting outlook.
I guess we'll have to wait and see what hatches out of all this.
Vic, you're going to have to stop with these egg analogies.
Roger that. But one thing is clear. Whether the EU succeeds or fails in engineering innovation, no one can blame it for not having tried. We hope you enjoyed this episode. We tried out a bit of a different format this time, so we would be especially happy to get your feedback on this. Did you like it, and should we produce more episodes like this one?
For more content, make sure to follow us on X, formerly Twitter, where you'll find us with the handle EU_untangled, and on Instagram and Facebook, where you find us with EU.untangled. And last but not least, we also have a Mastodon account. You find us there with EU_untangled at EUpolicy.social.
You can find EU Untangled on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your pod. Don't forget to give us a rating. It really helps other people discover the podcast.
And of course, you can always visit our website, www.untangledmediaspodcast.eu, where you can find all of our past episodes. And of course, you can also shoot an email at us, mail@untangled-podcast.eu. We would love to hear from you. Bis bald.
Bye.